The following message is from Christ Community Church in Athens, Georgia. For more information and sermons, go to www.christ-community.com. Thank you for listening.
This will be a familiar text to some, but not all. But please understand that for whatever reason that you're here, you're not here by accident. And no matter how familiar you are with this text, God has something to say to you. We said at the beginning, there's no one else. There's nothing else like our God. He's consistent and steady, yes, but he's surprising and he knows the details of your life. So read with me as I begin reading in verse 11 of Matthew 28. I'll read through verse 20. Then I'll pray and then Ben will preach. Verse 11, while they were going, behold, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests all that had taken place. And when they had assembled with the elders and taken counsel, they gave a sufficient sum of money to the soldiers and said, tell people, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. So they took the money and did as they were directed. And this story has been spread among the Jews to this day. Verse 16. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and said to them, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. Let's pray together. Jesus, thank you for the promise that you are with us. You have been with us. You will be with us. And you are with us now. Thank you for Ben. Thank you for his story. Thank you for your work of grace in his life. Thank you for the gifts that you've given him that not only bless so many students on the University of Georgia campus, but are here now to bless us. I thank you for his wife. I thank you for his family. I thank you for what lies ahead as we see you and know you even more than we do now. Would you bless this time and work in an uncommon way in the ordinariness of speaking and listening? For your glory, for our joy. Amen. Ben, come on up and preach, brother.
Well, thank you, Matt. And it's great to be here with y'all this morning. My wife Anna and I and our three kids who are down the hall. You may see them. Our kid has escaped a couple of times from church nurseries and come right in the middle of the sermon. So you may yet meet Eli this morning if he gets out. But Matt, thanks for the way you've loved us. You and Lindsay and y'all's family have received us back to Athens. Thanks to this church, y'all have loved us well. We had some great weeks with you this summer, and we'll continue in the years ahead to be here with you and worship with you this morning. So thank you for that. Thanks for your introduction, too, and for this church's support and love of RUF. I tell our students, RUF is like an ambulance. There come moments in your life where brokenness happens, injuries happen, where you need the resources of the hospital, but you can't get to the hospital, and so you need them brought to you. And so the ambulance comes and meets you where you are. And that's a good thing, and it's a really, really bad thing if the ambulance remains where you are and can't take you back to the richer, greater, more long-term resources of the hospital. RUF is, when you see it, in particular this church working at UGA, see Christ Community engaging and working on the campus of UGA. We are a ministry sent out by this church, sent out by the churches in Athens, and so that's a real thank you. Not a polite thank you, but a real one for what you do. Well, this morning, Matt said it. It's a familiar passage to many, and that's one of the problems, is I've been reading this for a good chunk of my life. Perhaps you have too. We know it as what editors of the Bible have termed it, the Great Commission. But there's a little bit more going on here than I've realized in the past. I want to start with this question. Have you heard of the term or the concept of disruptive innovation before? You come across that term yet? It's a business term. You may have heard it, you may not have heard it, but it basically, a disruptive innovation is an invention, an idea, a new way of doing things that is so radical and so new that it revolutionizes an entire industry. It creates a whole new set of winners and losers. It makes certain technologies or methods or companies obsolete overnight. It challenges and changes the status quo, which means that disruptive innovations also create phenomenal amounts of pushback and resistance because it changes the status quo, creates a whole new class of winners and losers. But one thing is sure, when one of these disruptive innovations happens, everybody has to go back to square one and rethink everything moving forward. Now, even if you haven't heard the term in business, you know what I'm talking about because our whole lives have been one giant series of disruptive innovations. You still remember that family ritual of Friday nights walking the aisles at Vision Video or Blockbuster to pick out the video that your family's going to watch that weekend before you have to take it back the next day. And then, you know, that kind of gave way to Redbox and other little, like, kiosk machines that's starting to phase out now, and it's given way to streaming, to Netflix. Netflix is one of the greatest disruptive innovations we've seen and completely revolutionizes the industry, creates a whole new set of winners and losers. Blockbuster was the loser. The Motion Picture Association was the loser. These old kind of strongholds of power and influence in the entertainment industry have a lot less of it now, and it changes all of those things. Everyone has to now, if you want to play ball in that sphere, you've got to go back to square one and rethink everything. Amazon. We've been gone 10 years. We just got back in January, and driving up Baxter, I should have thought of this, but I'm driving there with my intern. I'm like, what's up with all of the bookstores being closed? Every single bookstore on Baxter, there's about 8 of them, are all shuttered now because of the disruptive innovation of Amazon. iTunes, smartphones, all of these things, they change everything, the way we date, the way we meet, the way we do our finances, the way we do productivity. It's disrupted everything. Whole new set of winners and losers, everyone back to square one, and you have to reimagine everything. There's two options when you're faced with this disruptive innovation. You can yield to it and get on board, or you can get left behind. And I'm sure, for whatever reason, there's some of you here who still have the flip phone, the dumb phone, and maybe you have great reasons for it, but life is a lot less convenient for you, right? In a sense, you've chosen to be left behind while everyone else is kind of streaming forward. If you choose not to get on board, the only other alternative is to be left behind. Now, the pushback. Each of these innovations that I talked about, inventions, was, you can go and follow a paper trail legally of how the MPAA tried to shut down Netflix and other places for piracy, trademark infringement, how the old Bell companies spread stories or paid lobbyists to spread stories that cell phones cause cancer. And all these other ways that these entrenched strongholds of power do not want these disruptions. They want tomorrow to be just like it was yesterday. They want predictability. They want certainty. And so they have a vested interest in not getting on board with any change, even if it leads to better lives, to greater thriving. Here's my point. I think we have plenty of warrant in the Bible to say this. Jesus' resurrection from the dead is history's greatest disruption. It's the greatest disruptive innovation the world has ever known. And all that I've said already is true, but with the volume turned all the way up. Jesus' resurrection is this new burst, this new historical moment that changes everything. Everybody has to go back to that point and rethink everything. It absolutely disrupts the status quo. It absolutely creates a whole new class of winners and losers. In his kingdom, the weak are the strong, the powerless are the powerful, and on and on. And it means that the options are we yield ourselves and get on board, or we are left behind as this whole new world surges forward. Think about that moment. Jesus, a dead body like every other dead body, 3 days after his heart stopped beating. necrosis has happened. Rigor mortis has been happening for 3 days. Cellular functions have ceased and cell walls are breaking down. Decomposition has started. Muscles are tight little balls. And there was a 1 millisecond where he was dead and 1 millisecond where for the first time synapses start firing again, collapsed blood veins start to fill up again, heart muscles start to have electricity again and beat again. And that first breath, can you imagine the sound of the first inhale of resurrection life, of indestructible life, of God's new creation bursting into hell? That's what we mean when we say disruptive innovations. And we need to dig a little bit deeper here before we move on, because when the Bible talks about resurrection, even what I just described, the Bible's fascination and fixation with resurrection isn't in the sense of a magic trick. Get a load of this. Jesus was dead and God said abracadabra and now he's alive. Isn't that amazing? You should believe in him and trust in him because of this magic trick that God did. Isn't he powerful? Not at all. That's never how the Bible talks about the resurrection. Nor is it some physiological marvel, which is kind of what I just described to you. The Bible's fixation, fascination, God from beginning to end in his scriptures, in his revelation, here's the rubric of resurrection. Here's how the Bible's kind of arithmetic of thinking about resurrection. Here's the rubric. Guilty people die, innocent people live. That's Deuteronomy. That's part of the covenant. The wages of sin is death. If you live by, if you obey these commands, then you will live. And if you break them, you will die. Cursed is every man who's hanged on a tree, the scriptures say. The proof that a human being was guilty is that they die. That's the verdict. That's the proof that this was a person condemned and liable. The proof that a person is innocent, that is righteous to the core, holy, good, is that they live. That's the Bible's arithmetic in life and death and how this works. And so we have a dilemma. And the Bible has this continual question mark over it that it's answering repeatedly is, then, if what I'm saying is true, how did the second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ, God in the flesh, in time and in space, wind up dead as dead can get? Because if what I've said is true, how does he, remember, death is the proof positive that you're guilty, that you are in fact opposed to God, that at some level you are in fact at odds with him, are in fact liable for what you've done and not done, then how does Jesus die? Because that all holds true in that moment. And the flip side is just as problematic in a sense. Then how does he raise up? How does he come back to life? How does a dead man bearing the proof of guilt become a living man, an innocent, resurrected person? Well, the Bible talks about this great trade. It's not the point of this passage, but it's important that we get this in our minds before we push on. All that resurrection involved in it, that's packaged inside of this reality of resurrection, is that Jesus really did, really was accounted condemned in our place. He who knew no sin became sin so that we might become the righteousness of God. There was a very real trading of places. The proof, if you ever doubt, side note, if you ever doubt, has God really, really, even after this week, even after yesterday, even after this morning before coming here, did he really cover all of that? The proof is Jesus' dead body. He really was accounted guilty. He really was condemned. Am I free from those things? Am I a new man, a new woman with a new future, new potential, new opportunities? The proof of that is what happened just before Matt started reading. The women go to the tomb because it's smelling bad, because there's a dead body inside, and there's a big problem. He's not there. And they don't assume what we might assume with 2,000 years of hearing stories of this. Their assumption is a natural one. Someone stole him. This is really bad. As if Friday wasn't bad enough, now he's gone. And who knows what's being done? Are they going to hang him in the public square and say, let's do it again, let's parade his deadness in front of everyone? So they go to the tomb and they find that he's alive, and it was a real resurrection, enough that a rock moved and footsteps leave, and he goes on his way. And so, just remember with me, no magic trick, no physiological marvel, but theological apocalypse in the best of sense, a full revealing, a game changer, the greatest disruptive innovation that will never be matched in human history. If this is true, if it's true that what's happening in the later accounts of the gospel is that this game-changing, pivotal, historical moment happened, then we had better believe, if it's the greatest disruption in history, it produces the greatest pushback and resistance in history too, right? It's the greatest changing of the power structures that be. Racial power structures, Paul gets into this plenty in the New Testament, Jew, Gentile, Greek, barbarian, male, female, all of these different things. Power structures of who's in with God and who's out with God, the alienated, the far have been brought in. And the seeming insiders, the people you would most expect to be near to God are exposed to be very far from him. The status quo changes. And so there's an unprecedented disruption and an unprecedented pushback to it, because the people in this account are just like us. Don't you love the status quo? Don't you want work to be as good as it was last year if it was good for you? Don't you want marriage or parenting to be as good as it is, good as it was yesterday? This is a big hypothetical here. If it was good yesterday, don't you want tomorrow to be great too? Don't you want your health to be intact as it is right now? We love the status quo. That's not inherently bad, but we've got to know we have a vested interest in it. That's why we don't like disruptions, annoyances, interruptions to our plans. Well, they're the same as we were. And because of their love for the status quo, the way things had always been, they had to stick with it. They couldn't entertain the possibility that Jesus really did raise from the dead, that all of those messianic prophecies actually did come true in this man, Jesus of Nazareth. And we see in this passage Matthew toying with these ideas and ending his gospel in a really strategic way with how he ends this. And this is something I'd never seen until recently. I always thought of this passage as the Great Commission, when in fact what Matthew is doing is laying out two simultaneous commissions back to back. Two kings, one a pretender, one legit, sending their subjects, sending their disciples out into the world with a message to tell all the world, to disciple the world in a narrative. The devil, or you could say the forces of evil, here manifest in the chief priests and the elders, the religious authorities. They go out and they are told, the guards come back and they say, we have a huge problem, the body is not there. Usually what happens is they're killed when they don't do their job like that. And so they come in, they tell the chief priests and the elders, they have taken counsel. The elders, chief priests, gave them a sufficient sum of money. That's whatever sufficient is enough to keep your mouth shut. To the soldiers, and they say, here's the first commission, tell the people. His disciples came by night and stole him away while we were sleeping. And by the way, if this comes to your boss's ears, we've got your back. We'll satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. So they took the money, the bribe was hatched, they did as they were directed. Here's the point. This gospel was written decades after this event happened. 20, 30, 40 years after, and Matthew notes, and this story has been spread among the Jews to this day. Very dutiful disciples who had repeated and preached and proclaimed the narrative that Jesus is dead. There's some other explanation for what happened, but he is still dead. He is not alive, and none of the things I talked about earlier are therefore true because he is still dead. I came of age, probably in my high school years, college years, all the Dan Brown novels were coming out, and you know, some people were scared, oh no, he's like saying fallacious things about the church or church history, and some people were like, this is so cool. But you see in his narratives, Angels and Demons or Da Vinci Code, there's this cultural narrative that goes around that basically some of the church's most historic strategic moments happened in dark, smoky rooms when it was a room full of men basically deciding how to maintain power. Every church council is described this way. Every moment in the Gospels is described this way. And it's interesting to see that this did in fact happen. There was a dark, smoky room filled with men hatching a scheme of what to tell the people. And it's the moment when the devil commissions his forces that continues to our day in 2018. It's a narrative that not just Jesus physiologically didn't come back to life, but it's any narrative that asserts that you're still dead in your sins, that God is not a God who has feet and moves towards need and brings life where death had reigned. It's a narrative that there is no hope. It's a narrative that the world is just spinning. It's just happening. It's a cynic's narrative. There's no meaning to any of this. It's a satanic script that has been rippling around planet Earth since this moment. The same moment that the narrative of Jesus' resurrection goes around, right? We're talking real-time correlation. As soon as they realized the tomb was empty, go tell the people this. And this can happen in a thousand or a million different ways to this day of how the narrative is told that there is no hope, that Jesus is not unique, that exclusive life is not found in him. Come on, people, don't be so, you know, moderation, come on. Like, don't get so caught up in this religious stuff. This narrative wears a thousand different outfits, but it's always the same at its core. You're dead. You're without hope. You of all people are the most to be pitied. Your faith is futile. This is all, if you want to go read 1 Corinthians 15 later, take everything Paul said and reverse it. That's what's true if Jesus didn't raise from the dead. And every funeral you go to and every death you fear for yourself or your loved ones now takes a very dark and gloomy turn, because God has never moved an inch. He's never flinched to meet us in our sorrows and in our gloom. Bible refutes this throughout. Paul says throughout his writings, don't just take my word for it. He says in 1 Corinthians 15, there's 500 people still alive at the time of the writing of that letter who saw the resurrected Jesus. So he's almost cueing the journalist, hey, go do your job. Interview these people. See if their accounts line up. Do the historian's job. Go do your work. Ask for the in-depth accounts. Verify whether they were present there or not. John says in 1 John and in his gospel and in Revelation, he talks about the tactile interaction they had with the physically resurrected Jesus. We have seen him with our eyes. We have heard him with our ears. We have touched him with our hands concerning the word of life, the life which was made manifest, and we have seen it. That which we have seen and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you may have fellowship with us, with the Father, with the Son, Jesus Christ. You see the importance of all of this? If the devil's narrative is true, everything falls apart. And we should literally get up and go right now, because this is a monumental waste of a Sunday morning. The Bible makes the account very clear. This happened in real life. Last side note on this point. I spent much of my life not united to Jesus, not believing some of this stuff. I thought I did. I thought I understood of it, but really just had no interest. I loved my status quo. I loved my comfort. I loved the way life was going without kind of what I thought of the bore of God and my submission to him. And I look back at that, and I was like, I didn't reject the resurrection of Jesus or the gospel. I didn't reject it for rational reasons. Beneath the arguments, beneath the seemingly rational reasons, was really just this: I loved this more than this. I didn't want to give this up. And I think we can say that with respect. We can entertain real legitimate objections to the gospel, to the scriptures, to these accounts. We can converse about them. We can talk about them. But at the end of the day, I think it's helpful to realize there's always a reason beneath the presenting reasons why this is hard to swallow. And it always has to do with your other loves. Your greater faiths, your greater desires always supersede the desire to entertain the possibility this is true. And therefore, we present whatever reason I believe this instead of this, or I can't believe that because of this logical or scientific or philosophical reason. They're not real. Beneath it all is a very personal reason, of why it's too threatening to entertain the possibility that it just might be true. I love this. This is one of the reasons when students will ask, or people will ask, I just can't believe the Bible's true. It's too silver liney. It's naive. I'm like, well, okay, let's start reading the Bible and we'll see. This is the end of Matthew's gospel. If you're a film director or whatever, wouldn't you expect the last minute or two of your movie is going to be the most thought out? How do I wrap this up? How do we build the tension? How do we tie all the loose ends together? And that does not happen in Matthew's gospel, because this happens. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. And when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted, some being some of the apostles. And Jesus came and said to them, I love that. There's no explanation for it. Jesus doesn't take issue with it, but this little parenthetical aside of this climactic moment, Jesus is in fact raised from the dead. And it's his first time seeing all of his disciples, his apostles. And it's like, and they worshiped him, but some doubted. And Jesus continues, all authority on heaven and earth has been given to me. Go therefore into all the world. And I love that, because what this means is that this is not an apologetic text, simply. This is a passage that's designed to wrestle with the suspicions and doubts in your heart just as well. There is kind of a hard and fast rejection of the resurrection. Maybe someone would say, I don't believe that for these historical reasons, but there is a deeply existential, personal, spiritual, emotional rejection of the resurrection too, and we feel it every day. Whenever you feel stuck in your sin, in your guilt, in your shame, when your marriage can't get better, God won't show up there, and your sexual brokenness, whatever form that takes, I'm never changing. There is no conceivable way God could be faithful to me in the midst of this struggle. That's when our hearts deny that life has sprouted in the epitome of death. Hope has invaded the stronghold of hopelessness. And they worshiped him, but some doubted. We worship him, and we doubt. There are still further shores that the ripples and the waves of this climactic moment have yet to reach in our lives. And so this commission that Jesus sends out his disciples out onto, it's usually a text for missions conferences. This is why you should go be a missionary or support missionaries. But you got to remember the ground. If Jesus is saying go over there, he's also saying go right here and go right there and go right there and go right there. And he does. He kind of geographically, he does that. But he's saying, look to the person in the seat to your left or your right, whether it's a spouse, a child, a friend, a stranger. They doubt this. And part of what the Church of Jesus Christ is called to do is to speak in such a way, live in such a way, anticipate in such a way that we are helpful to each other in alleviating those doubts and shedding lights on it and putting an arm around someone and saying, I know you can't see through the fog right now, but I can. And let me tell you what's going to happen. Let me tell you what's happening around us. I know it feels like winter, but I see spring. There's green on those brown dead branches, and it's slowly coming back. This commission is for us to take care of each other. It's for you to take care of your wife, your husband, your mom, your dad, and yourself. Don't you have to preach this to yourself too? Don't you have to cross-examine that inner dialogue and call it for what it is, a satanic lie that is being spread to this day inside you and around you? And we must come and say, no, I know people who touched him, who saw him. And if Jesus raised from the dead, it's not just that I've got to prove myself this historically happened. Remember, that's not what we're talking about. 1 Corinthians 15 roots the historical event to the spiritual reality. You are not dead in your sins if in fact he raised. You are beloved. You are vindicated, because that's what the Bible always describes Jesus' resurrection as, the vindication of the Son of God. You have been publicly vindicated. God does not shy away from owning you in public. He shouts it out with no shame. You're mine. I have purchased you. I have redeemed you. Friends, our commission is to refute satanic hogwash, whether it happens in the workplace, around your dinner table, in your heart, in your mind. That's the call that we have been given. Lastly, how does this happen? How are we to go about this? How does this confrontation of truth and lies, of reality and deception, how does this happen? Well, Jesus sends us out to do this. But he always did this. The way people's lives were changed is they either met the resurrected Jesus in person, like Paul did, like these apostles did, and their lives were changed forever, or they met the people of the resurrected Jesus. They met people who are united to the resurrected Jesus, which you are if you've looked to him by faith. You are one with Jesus now. And all of us, if you're a Christian, you're a Christian because one of his resurrected people, right? A pastor, a family member, a friend, a boss, someone argued with your doubts. Someone got in your business. Someone disrupted your status quo. And Jesus, through that person, showed you, don't resist. Life is what I'm giving you. Freedom is what I'm bringing to you. Hope is what I'm restoring, not killing you. There's no need to fear this. Yes, it will absolutely, radically revolutionize your life. Yes, you must go back to square one and rethink everything. Yes, it does disrupt the winners and losers in your lifestyle. But it is for your good. And so, this is why I'm talking about we are called to both embody to each other the resurrection of Jesus, which the Bible calls the fruits of the Spirit. We love each other. We bear patiently with each other. We overlook sin until it's destructive to the person. We confront lovingly. We have each other over. We know each other's names. All of these things are ways that we refute the darkness in the lives of the devil around us and in us. I want to end with a story. What's the motivation for this? What's going to get you out of bed tomorrow thinking about this and next week and next year? I saw an American Express commercial recently. Of all things, a credit card company does this. It was one of those 3 or 4 minute YouTube ads, and you're like surprised at minute 3, you're still watching. How did they get me? And so I'm watching this thing, and it's basically, at first, it's not that interesting. It's a bunch of very young, driven entrepreneurs, and this guy started up some like dog food online business that's multi-million dollars now, and this lady started some flower delivery business, whatever, you know. And these are kind of the most ambitious of our culture. They're strong. They're talking about their business model, and then it cuts to little short vignette interviews of their employees. And so this lady's saying, like, I for 30 years have hated driving into work every day, until I started working at Jeff's company. My coworkers are family to me. This company has changed my life. And someone else talks about the grace that they've been shown by this person, overlooking some of the hiccups of their early days in the company. And other people talk about the vision, the leadership, the risk that this person has intercepted on our behalf so that we can thrive. And then the last piece of the last minute of this ad was bringing these CEOs into this, like, cool hipster warehouse, and there's a big screen. They don't know what they're about to get. They walk in, and projected on this back screen are these interviews of their employees. And to a person, they all start weeping. Not tearing up, weeping. And when they compose themselves, they say, I never knew I had an impact. I never knew I made a difference. And my question to you is, if they had known ahead of time, you will impact your employees this way, you will make one of the biggest differences in their lives, would that have changed the way they drive into work every day? Would that have increased their motivation? Do you think it would have eased their nerves, perhaps let them sleep better at night, if they had been guaranteed in the beginning, you will make a difference, guaranteed? When Jesus says, all authority on heaven and on earth has been given to me, he's talking to people who have been united to him. And so all authority on heaven and earth has been given to his church as well, as if to say, you are guaranteed, you individuals, now you plural, but you individually will make a difference because the Spirit of Jesus, the Spirit of resurrection, abides in you. You will make a difference. You will matter. you will make an impact. Does that change how you move out into your days from now? Jesus says, "Behold, I will be with you until the end of the ages," as if to say, Church of Jesus Christ, you're on offense now. We don't play defense anymore. We don't do the culture war thing. We don't fret where history's going. We know where it's going. We are on offense. We are available to love our city, our neighbors, our country, because we win. Resurrection wins, life wins, grace wins, the person love wins. Let's pray.